Willkommen zum Podcast der Initiative Regenerative Marktwirtschaft. Hier wollen wir herausfinden, wie eine umweltfähige Zukunft macht.
Welcome to today's episode for the podcast of the Initiative for the Regenerative Market Economy. And we're in the beginning, in the opening of season 2, which revolves around learning how to engage with community, how to get people into coherence around what they think a good life is. And I'm super happy and honored to have Adam here today. And as usual, we will start with the hardest question in straight up in the beginning, so that we know where Adam's coming from. Adam, who are you?
Well, thanks, Thomas, for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here with you and to talk about this super important topic. I think if I was in a traditional podcast, being interviewed by a company or an organization that, sits within the realm of normal thought, the answer to this question would be very formal. It'd be like my name and where I'm from and what I do, okay. Right? Yeah. But since we are operating, I think, on a different frequency level, I'll go a little bit deeper than that. So who I am is divine being expressed in this physical body that was given the name of Adam and is still in the process of unraveling the full spectrum of everything that I actually am beyond that which I know already. So currently, I'm a man born in the United States from Colorado in the countryside up in the mountains. And since a young kid, I think I had a very deep connection with spirituality and nature and trying to understand our greater purpose as humans on this planet and what it is our objective. So I think who I am is directly tied also to my purpose, and the purpose that I've unraveled so far for why I'm here is to be a bridge builder, to help connect worlds that are otherwise disconnected. So worlds of abundance with worlds of scarcity, worlds of harmony with worlds of conflict. And growing up as a child, highly connected with nature, I always am looking about how can we create synchronicity between the laws and universal rules of existence and that which we're playing in this game of life, of business and organizations and money and resources, and constantly trying to question the status quo to figure out how can we build a reality that's in alignment with what's interesting for all of us. So I've been living this physical experience for 36 years. I currently live in Rio de Janeiro. I live in a favela called Vigigal, so a low-income urban community in the city of Rio de Janeiro. And I've dedicated my life to building organizations and nonprofits and businesses that can fulfill this purpose of creating connectivity and mutual purpose.
Oh, thank you for that. Going far beyond the usual, this is Adam and he does that. so that was beautiful. I want to dig into the almost one of the very first words that you said. You mentioned divine. What does that mean to you? I have a sense, but I'd like to unpack that for our listeners.
It's a great question. For me, divine is actually everything that is and that can be perceived. I think there's a tendency to separate spirituality from everything else. Mm-hmm. And I look at life as everything is spiritual and we're spiritual beings living a physical experience. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, I try to take the approach that everything is divine mm-hmm. in its essence. And then, the mind allocates a judgment on things that we say are good or are bad, or as divine or not divine, or, godly or devil oriented. But for me, I try not to put things into these boxes. Mm-hmm. And ultimately I think that everything is part of this divine essence, and it's all about us observing that and leveraging the consciousness that we've achieved up until now to find the divinity behind everything that it is that we interact with.
Mm-hmm. Would it be fair to say that it's similar to, if I say something like life force, in a very foundational way, meant in a very foundational way? Would that be roughly what you say with divine?
Yeah, divine is mm-hmm. is the underlying elements that compose everything that is. It's the life force. Mm-hmm. It's the universal energies and the vibrations that mm-hmm. that collaborate to construct this reality.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it strikes me that you probably weren't a very average, normal boy in the context of Colorado when you were growing up. So how was that experience for you? Were you like we're experiencing you right now, or were you different? Did you shape yourself or morph into this human that you're right now, or were you always probably different than the rest? And how did that feel?
Yeah. I think the way that I am now is probably more similar to how I was when mm-hmm. I first came into the world. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. through the processes of conditioning and interaction mm-hmm. with different influences of life, you know, whether that's mm-hmm. parents or teachers or people or society as a whole, there a dissonance is created between mm-hmm. the who I was and that who I was being. Mm-hmm. And I think that created a lot of questions around identity and mm-hmm. and chaos of understanding of my underlying purpose. So for a long period of time, I was very scared of the world. I was very shy. Mm-hmm. I was always kind of hiding, you know, from expressing everything that was going on inside me from a place of fear. You know, in middle school and high school, I suffered mm-hmm. a lot of bullying for those reasons. So I was a very much a disempowered child, you could say, in that sense. Mm-hmm. And eventually there was a breakthrough where I started to realize that personality is fluid, and also that I can be whoever I want to be. And so I think through that process, there's been a variety of key transformations and evolutions where I've started to come back into more coherence with who I actually am, and without any fear or self-judgment of expressing that in its totality, which is where I feel that I'm at today.
Mm-hmm. That means that you first had the capacity, needed the capacity to sense the dissonance and react and articulate the dissonance that you were feeling between who you somehow knew you were and the version of you that was being created by the environment you found yourself in. Where do you think that dissonance, or that sense of feeling that dissonance and responding to that dissonance came from for you?
Well, I think the dissonance comes from a societal structure.
Mm-hmm. I think the dissonance is clear. So the environment shapes you.
Yeah.
And you feel that whatever the environment is shaping you into is dissonant with who you are at your core. Right. I'm wondering, what does it take to notice this? That's what I'm trying to ask.
Mm. I think initially it comes from a place of feeling unhappy or unsettled or scared of being rejected by the status quo. So I think most of the time, people, and in my case, you have to confront, there's a point of confrontation, existential confrontation, where you don't feel like you fit in with everything else, or something feels off, like why am I sad, or why am I not more satisfied with my experience? Mm-hmm. And then the more you question and dive into that, eventually there's a transition from that space of dissonance and exclusion to realizing I'm allowed to express the totality of who I am and bring quality of life into my physical experience in a way that maybe society hasn't contemplated yet. But I think it usually starts with some kind of chaotic or seemingly catastrophic experience of feeling completely left out.
So in a way, that's what you were describing as being bullied was in hindsight maybe even a good thing, because it gave you that possibility of growing beyond or back into remembering who you were before. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, I think all of those challenges required me to go deeper within myself to say, who am I? And the more that we can ask that question and look for the responses, they begin to reveal themselves in different ways. But many times it requires a significantly challenging life experience in order to get to that space that could be achieved right from the beginning. But because it's almost like a process of remembering, we have to have these, you know, unique occurrences that awaken that within us.
Okay. So all of that puts you into being deeply aware of yourself, because as you described it, you've chosen who you are. So by definition, you know who you're building yourself, which makes you super aware that you are present in the world, and you know who you are and what you want to contribute. And you said that you have dedicated your life to this work that you're doing. And so that is a good starting point for being able to help groups of people get into a modality of something similar, that as a group of people building towards something that group of people dreams of coherently, and there's a shared building, a shared dream. But before you can start building that shared dream, you have to get into a sense of what is your shared dream as a group, as a community. And I'm wondering, what is your experience around that? So how would you go about, or how do you go about helping a group of people get into coherence about the world they want to see?
Well, I think the first phase starts with understanding those which we want to bring into coherence, and facilitating a process of deconstruction of that which you aren't. So in a practical sense, when I moved to Rio and I recognized that in these favela communities where all these low-income families have lived and for over 500 years have been going through extensive colonialism and racial discrimination, and I realized that I had a capacity as a white, blue-eyed male from the United States to contribute to their reality, maybe in a way that they weren't able to independently construct, I had to answer this question, which was, first of all, who are these people, and at their essence, and what is it that they truly care about? What makes them happy? But a lot of the times, groups that are, let's say, consciously or unconsciously going through a process of achieving coherence, they themselves do not have the immediate answer to that question. So there's the facilitator role, which is ultimately what I had to play. So I visited 150 different favela communities throughout Brazil, and I interviewed all these different protagonists of this ecosystem. So from a teacher to a police officer to the head of a drug trafficking gang to a single mother raising her family, they all are very different, apparently. But what I was looking for is, what is the underlying stream of commonality that links them together? And so by spending time with them, but also by not bringing in my own judgment of what is right and what is wrong about who they are, and also doing my research to understand what it is that they've gone through, and practicing extreme empathy, I was able to dive deep into the essence of what they really want as individuals. And so I think that's the first step, is then asking them questions to say, this way that you're being, or this way that you're feeling, or this way that you're living, where did that come from? Who told you that you needed to be a certain way? mm-hmm. do a certain thing or value certain things like money. Mm-hmm. And then they can naturally through that deconstruct themselves. So instead of mm-hmm. an external force imposing on them, you mm-hmm. need to be this way. They mm-hmm. come to a clarity of, oh, this is who I am. So I'm not a poor person. That's not a fundamental piece of my identity. I was told that I'm poor. My grandmother said that we are poor and we always be poor and that's who you are. But that's not actually an idea that I want to believe in. So once we can deconstruct this idea, then we can help reconstruct that which is truly at the core of what the individuals want, which, you know, mm-hmm. I think comes down to happiness. And mm-hmm. when then you can ask the question, well, what makes you happy? Mm-hmm. So by understanding these individual needs and once the people start to reconstruct collectively their identities, then we can help shape common goals and common methodologies and common systems that allow people to both maintain their individuality while adhering to a collective agreement of that which everybody has in common. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's kind of the process of how we can move people towards coherence.
Okay, so you start with individual conversations where you have to be extremely skillful in your questions and also be sure not to add too much of your own ideas into those questions. So to be truly open, I think that's a challenge. And maybe we come back to that later, how to deal with these kinds of challenges. But then once you've done that with individual people, how do you take the next step? How do you group them into an understanding of each other? Because now you are at the core understanding all of these people, but they are not really aware of them, each other. What's the next step for you?
It's a very challenging element, especially when we're talking about working in territories where extreme discrimination and violence have been at the core of creating separation between people. Yeah. There's a lot of hate. There's a lot of judgment. There's a lot of misunderstanding. So in our cases, what we decided to do was, as an organization, we create a physical spaces where there's things of interest. It could be an educational process of learning something or a tool or a resource somebody needs. Maybe someone needs access to internet and they don't have it, or they need access to a computer and they don't have it. And in this physical space, they're able to get access to that tool, that knowledge that satisfies immediate short-term need. Mm-hmm. And then when you have different types of people sharing space together, achieving their own individual needs with a facilitator that's mapping and analyzing and seeing where is one person's need met by another person's skill or capacity, mm-hmm. right? And mm-hmm. creating matching between mm-hmm. These needs and these challenges, then people start to find common ground in mm-hmm. seeing that they want the same things and that they have the same goals. Now, that can be challenging when there's external influences that don't want these forces to come together. So if you take a drug trafficker and a police officer mm-hmm. and you put them together, right? They've been told and trained their entire life to hate each other and to want to kill each mm-hmm. other. Mm-hmm. So now how can we help them find the common humanity within each other in order for there to be peace and harmony and collaboration and coherence ultimately, right?
Okay.
And I think it starts with finding people who in some way are embodying that already mm-hmm. and giving them space and voice so that people can connect with that. So for example, here in the favela where I live, there's a police officer who gives guitar classes for free for people in the favela. Mm-hmm. So music in this sense was a common ground mm-hmm. where that when they had a guitar and they're sitting in a circle, everything else goes away. and the human love and passion for art brings them together, which opens up space for dialogue and other possibilities. But I think it's about leveraging those common elements together is one of the ways that we can eventually get there. Of course, education is an essential tool as well in helping expand people's consciousness of you know what's actually happening, but that this takes more time.
Okay, I'm going to try and repeat to distill how I'm hearing what you're doing. So you understand people individually, you create an attractor in the form of something that you know is a common need for many people, so that you can have a physical attractor where people actually run into each other. And then you facilitate short-term need satisfaction between those people as well to weave them into something more. What else happens? When does that group become aware of itself as being a group? Or doesn't that need to happen even? I don't know. How do you think about that?
Yeah, well, there's two things. I think the first thing I want to say is another essential element to that process, which came to me now, is also about representation. So if, for example, we helped connect scholarships for university bachelor's degrees to people in the favela that had not even finished high school yet, so that they could go to university, right? If I, as an educated white person, show up and say, all of you can go to university and study, and here's this amazing program, the initial reaction is, well, it's easy for you to say you're white and privileged and you have these things. You know, I'm not going to go to university. I don't even know how I'm going to pay my bills tomorrow. But if you select somebody from their community who is Black, who came from the same background as them, who went to university, got a degree and transformed their lives, and in a round of hip-hop rapping, this person shows up and we integrate educational terms, and then this individual shares their life story, then people start to believe and that this is also possible for themselves. So this also facilitates the group identity element that you're talking about, which is initially you have to meet people where they're at in terms of the group that they identify with. Mm-hmm. So if I'm from a favela, we say in Portuguese, eu sou favelado. I'm from the favela. Mm-hmm. So these people already immediately identify themselves as pertaining to this group of low-income Black people that come from a favela, and within that sphere, collaboration, in theory, is easier. Now, to expand that into understanding, okay, but I'm part of this group that's also called humanity, or Brazilian, or South American, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's about expanding slowly the community of which people pertain to by increasingly bringing more people from the next level of community into contact. So once we have people in favelas acting in coherence, then we can take, let's say, high-income white people from the rich neighborhoods and connect them, so they can say, oh, we're all from Rio de Janeiro. We all care about having a city that we love to be a part of. And then now they can identify as people who are from Rio. So I don't think it's necessary that people identify as part of the group in order for them to collaborate effectively. But eventually, in an ideal world, if everybody can see the highest level of collective existence that they pertain to as a group and the things that are in common, I think we reach a place of having the highest chance of having harmony and happiness for everyone. But I don't think everybody is necessarily ready for that immediately. No, so just allowing them to exist within the community that they're able to identify with now and be a good contributing citizen that helps them individually and collectively is a great starting point.
Mm-hmm. When do you notice that a group is ready for basically the next step. So we've talked about you understanding who's there, then bringing people together, but then connecting is the next step. So that people need to be ready for being connected. And then people need to be ready for accepting outside a new world into that small world. When do you notice that group is ready?
I think it's somewhat organic.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense when people start saying things like, what about if we created a partnership with so-and-so?
Okay.
Or even sometimes it can come from a judgment like, well, we're never going to be able to do anything here because we're not white people with access to money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you could say, okay, so what would it look like then for you to be able to collaborate with the white people who have money for a common interest? I had an interesting conversation recently with a gentleman who is a Black entrepreneur, very successful. And I noticed that he was very open to working with me and with he had a lot of partners who were white and had money, mm-hmm. which maybe wouldn't be so common.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him, you know, about that, because previously, and this is a big movement in Brazil, are these Black only communities.
Mm-hmm.
So you have, you know, the Black Entrepreneurship Network, the Black banks, the Black mm-hmm. finance projects, right? Where the spaces are bringing Black protagonists to teach mm-hmm. and share resources amongst each other so that mm-hmm. they can support each other to be stronger in a world where they're weaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's super important that these spaces exist mm-hmm. where I can't go and mm-hmm. and that's sacred to them. And this gentleman, he participated in a lot of these Black only ecosystems. And so I asked him, I said, do you think that this is ultimately beneficial to create, let's say, segregation or segmentation mm-hmm. of people where there's not interconnectivity? And he said, yes, it's very important to have these spaces for people who still need that space in order to feel mm-hmm. safe. But in his sense, he realized that by only existing in those communities, he was limiting himself to accessing the people who had resources, money, and power who weren't those people. And so at some point he had to create alliances and say, where is their common benefit? How can you leverage my Blackness and my access to my community? And how can I leverage your whiteness mm-hmm. so that we can create things that are mutually beneficial? Mm-hmm. So he got to that place himself mm-hmm. by achieving a certain level of success and then seeing, look, if I want to go to the next level, I need to reach mm-hmm. out and I need to do more. And I think it's about observing organically when that moment happens and when people start verbally expressing that desire.
Mm. So there's one unresolved question that I had earlier, which is, does the group notice it's a group at one point, or is that irrelevant?
I think the group realizes it's a group when somebody puts a title on it and says it's a group.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's kind of an immediate identification. We are a group and this is what mm-hmm. we do. And these are the mission, vision, and values that we adhere mm-hmm. to. Right? Then it's quite obvious. Mm-hmm. Is that necessary for coherence is your question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, right? that's the question, yes.
Yeah. I don't think it's necessary in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
But I think once the group recognizes it's a group, then it gains an additional level of power and capacity to expand and to collaborate.
And also to create in-group, out-group dynamics, right? So like you just described with the Black groups segregating themselves, that's a very natural thing for humans to do, create in-group, out-group dynamics. So once you label it, is it we're a group, then there are people who are not in the group, and that doesn't necessarily make it easier. So my guess would be that it's actually more interesting not to label.
Yes, I agree.
Mm. Okay. But that's really hard to hold. So everything you've just described, I can see you do, right? I from knowing a little bit about your background and a little bit more about your work from our previous conversation, I can see that happening. I see how you can do it. I see it in front of my inner eyes, but it seems to be not a thing that comes natural to many people. So what would you say to somebody who sees what you're doing and who would like to do something like that, and but they don't know where to start? So how would you go about helping somebody get into the role that you're in?
Well, yeah, I definitely wouldn't recommend in terms of the easiest, the path of least resistance, that people do what I did.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I moved to Brazil straight from the United States, moved into a favela. I didn't speak the language. I didn't know anybody. I had no money. And I had this crazy belief that I could do something to change the life of these people. Mm-hmm. Right. And that required me to basically take on all of their characteristics for a period of time in order to understand them, in order to do things with them. So I had to learn the language. Then I had to learn all the dialects and the slang and the origin of where those things come from, the mannerisms, right, that you have to do. And at some point, it even led me to go into scarcity mentality, being in a scarcity-based ecosystem, because if you didn't have the scarcity mindset, and you're hanging out with a bunch of people that do, then you're actually not part of the group. And so there's no degree of influence until I realized that this was also destructive to my own mission. So I had to take myself to, you know, being out of money, living in the favela, you know, not sure how we're going to make ends meet, in order to fundamentally understand them at their core, in order to build something that was different. So that's a very radical methodology. If you're courageous and you want to step totally out of your comfort zone on a regular basis for a long period of time, go for it.
Okay.
But for your everyday citizen who wants to do something like that, I think it's you basically just are reverse engineering the process we talked to at the beginning. Not reverse, but individually practicing the process first. So first deconstructing yourself. Am I and who am I not? You know, reflecting through your life to make sure you're in actual alignment with your true identity. If you haven't done that for yourself, then you can't do that for others. Once you've gone through that process and you feel like you have a relative clarity of your life purpose and the things that drive passion and make you happy and move you, then observing around you in your immediate closest circle of influence, who are the people that are also that like that, and then you begin the process of the individualization that we talked about at the beginning, and then the collective identity development and bringing those people together around a common desire. So if you love nature and you love gardening and you love protecting the forest, and these are things that are really important to you, healthy eating, then you can find other people that also like that and show up with each of them and say, okay, who are you? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? What would it look like if you were able to do that better? What resources do you feel like you're not able to access that if you had access to could potentiate your capacity to live a life of purpose? And then start to look and connect those resources in a very clear way, so people can immediately start to feel the benefit of pertaining to a group, right? And as that starts to happen, then the organic process, I think, starts to come into place, which is the observing of people and their tendencies, the group think, and the desire of inner out-group dynamics like you talked about. Being born, and as that happens, you can start to look for the complementary groups or other people maybe that are doing the same thing, that have gone through a similar process, and saying, how can we connect these groups in a way that's mutually beneficial?
I think it's already emerges out of the process itself, but one thing I'm wondering is, Because if I look at groups and getting them into coherence from a more armchair academic perspective, I would say, well, there's a group that is in coherence now, but that's nice. But then what, right? Will they actually start doing something? But to me, it sounds like that your process inherently is action oriented in that it is driven by needs and desires, so that as coherence grows and also the foundation grows, that allows you to take the next step and widen the circle. Would you agree with that? Would you say that action is built into the process?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think action is at the center of that. Without the action, then people can start to feel like we're just sitting around and talking about things for no reason that actually isn't ever going anywhere. So I think the faster you can take actions that create immediate impact for people to see the benefit of pertaining to a group, the more buy-in people have, and the more they start to contribute without having to be asked or you know, motivated to do so.
You've built a lot of things over the years. Could you give us like 2-3 examples of action that emerged out of that process naturally, so that's where there was group coherence and out of that emerged a bigger need that then created a even bigger solution or whatever came out of it?
Absolutely. So during the pandemic, which we talked about at the beginning, how sometimes crisis and chaos is what can facilitate a waking up process, right? So when the pandemic came to the favelas, immediately we see all the people in the community are confronting a reality where they don't have a job. They can't work because they're not allowed to be on the streets. And most of these people live in the informal economy, right? So they're on the beach selling things, or they're carrying concrete sacks on their back for construction. And all of a sudden they're being told you can't work. So now they don't have money, which means they don't have food. And the basic hierarchy of needs is not being met, then people go into chaos. So in a way, that becomes all of a sudden the common element that everybody has, which is we need to eat. So if we don't work together, we're not going to have food. It's existential. And as an organization that we don't see ourselves as an aid organization, right? We're not in the business of finding people who are desperate and providing them with you know, a short-term solution that they perpetually need for the rest of their existence, you know. But that's not what I believe in. I believe in you know, helping people achieve autonomy in the long term. And so what do we do as an organization when everybody was coming to us and saying we need food, help us, but without becoming an aid organization? And on the other hand, I had people from outside the favelas contacting us saying, we want to provide food to people who are poor. So the way that would normally happen is they would show up with, you know, 100 kilos of rice and beans at a community center and say, we have rice and beans for people who need it. And then people are going to run there and take it, and then they'll be gone. And a lot of the time, the people that need that aid the most will not get it, because the people who are faster, smarter, and more efficient will be, or who have the best relationships, will be the first to get that resource, right? So as a ecosystem cultivator, how do we navigate that, right? So what we did was we said, okay, how can technology support us in this process? And why is there a challenge in figuring out how to distribute resources? Well, it's because people don't actually know the situation that other people are in. And there was no measurement for defining who needs what and when and how. So we start in the community by first mapping out all of the social projects, all of the NGOs or informal NGOs, the leaders in the community that help take care of people. And we visited them one by one, asking them who they are, what they're doing, and how they do it. And we trained people from the favela in programming. in partnership with a programming school. Then these people started to build an app and that registers the data of who these NGOs are and who these social project leaders are. So now we have a database of who are the articulators and the connectors within a community, what they do and what their challenges and what their needs are and what their strengths are. From that, we then went and registered the data of all of the people that those projects support. So in the favela where we are, this was 4,000 families, roughly speaking, from do they have Wi-Fi? Do they pay rent? Do they take prescription medication? Do they have a washing machine? What are their income sources? Do they have disabilities? Everything you can imagine. And then through a data analysis process, we're able to create indicators of vulnerability. But we didn't just do this like parallel and then start distributing food. We told people why we're doing this. And the people from the favela were involved in the programming. So people understand that, oh, if I'm not going to get food right now, it's because my neighbor's getting it first because they're actually more vulnerable than I am because somebody explained that to me. So through these distribution networks, we were able to then bring in the emergency food supplies, and we distributed 25,000 kilos of food and hygiene kits in a very targeted manner, making sure the right person got it at the right time and that the person that intermediated the relationship knew the family well enough to say these people actually need it. So it was bringing together qualitative data and quantitative data to make strategic decisions that were better for everyone. And what happened was we ended up having these monthly meetings because the people were like, well, who are these other projects and why are they part of it? So then we have a monthly meeting where each person is able to talk and say, hey, this is what I do and this is who I am. And if they said a common issue, let's say, was mutilation, children and adolescents were self-mutilating. And all of the NGO leaders were saying that this was a problem. So then we went out and found people who are specialists in training people on how to help people stop doing this. And we bring them into this community space to teach everyone. So now they all have this common issue. They're getting benefit from a common solution and they start connecting to each other around this common problem rather than fighting each other for scarce resources to distribute to their people. And anyways, by doing this over time, you know, we were able to create this cohesion between them. And since then we've leveraged this digital platform for connecting other things like job opportunity, training programs, education, but in a way where people aren't getting upset anymore that somebody else is being benefited because there's information that brings clarity.
So that was what you just described was basically a repetition of the core process. So instead of speaking to individuals, you spoke to the organizations, you really got an understanding of them. And then brought them to the table and found fresh problems that they all shared that you could then solve among them and scale the effort up through that. So it's very, like you say, very, very organic. And I can see how that creates new fruit constantly and the ability to expand. Have you yet seen a boundary where this kind of getting together in a physical way starts breaking down? Where does this end and how could you bridge that if it has a border?
Well, the main limitation that came up for us in being able to scale this more was money. Because it was very expensive, you know, to first build and maintain a technology platform, have facilitators who are collaborating with the process over time, who need to be paid in order to be dedicating their time and energy to do that. You have moments where a individual's needs are become so much stronger than the collective needs that they're not able to participate in the group process anymore. So let's say an NGO leader's husband passes away. And he was bringing in the money that allowed her to be able to focus full time on running an NGO. Now, all of a sudden, she doesn't know where the money's going to come from and how she's going to feed it. So forget the group process. I need money right now to survive till tomorrow. So breakdown can happen in that moment when people aren't being cared for on an individual level. Mm-hmm. And they feel like they have to go out and take care, take action into their own hands to mm-hmm. support themselves. And that there's not an immediate community of people that can help them do that in the short term. So that was one level of breakdown I saw where, you know, people may just disappear from the group and then you have mm-hmm. to go find out, hey, what's going on, and try to support them in that process. But not always is there time and resources, you know, to deal with the quantity of problems and the complexity of problems that can come about, mm-hmm. especially in a place like a favela where you have mm-hmm. you know, drug dealing, crime, trafficking, violence, all these other things that disrupt collaborative processes. So those were the like more internal disruptors, and the disruptors for us of an expansion was there's a pressure from people who have money to say, how is this going to make money so that we can give you money to contribute to continue to scale it? And if you mm-hmm. can't provide a clear business model that mm-hmm. puts money in their pocket, then they're not going to invest. Mm-hmm. And from a philanthropic state, well, you have so many people competing for the same resources that, you know, you can't guarantee always a continuancy of flow of resources to maintain that. So in mm-hmm. order for us to go from two favelas with, you know, 340,000 residents to 1,000 favelas with 17 million people, mm-hmm. it would take a significant investment over time, which I think can become financially self-sustainable. But mm-hmm. there has to be a permission for 10, 20, 30, 50 years to go by where maybe profit isn't generated so that the infrastructure, the systems, mm-hmm. the mind shifts can happen to create new possibilities. And a lot mm-hmm. of the times the agents that can contribute to that aren't ready for that, or they may see it as a threat to their own control and power dynamics.
Mm-hmm. It would be, I mean, essentially, you're doing what the government should be doing, right? So, and bridging that into public-private partnerships could happen through something like social bonds, if that concept exists and is being supported by the government. So, I fully get the challenge of that. And in terms of people and their possibility to connect and like on a person to person empathy based level, where would you say is the boundary? You mentioned 4,000 people or families, I don't remember, is that a natural boundary, or would you say we can go beyond that in structures like you're describing?
I think we can go beyond that. In this sense, I would say that there was more interconnectivity between the community leaders themselves than maybe the constituents that they support. Because those people all have already gotten to that place, you know, of collectivity. So it's hard to say what the timeline would be for when, you know, it's ready to expand beyond that. Mm-hmm. You know, our focus was, let's focus on favelas mm-hmm. because the traumas and the issues that people have gone through in favelas are similar enough that people can get to this place of connecting with each other and understanding the common fight and collaborating together. So you can have people in favelas on the north zone of the city who want to collaborate with people in the south zone of the city because they identify with where they come from and what they've gone through. Okay. So I think the initial expansion has to happen within a space where there's still a lot of commonality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And once you've achieved, let's say, a mass or maximized that level of interconnectivity, then you can go to other things, for example, like indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of historic correlations between what the indigenous people of Brazil have gone through mm-hmm. and what the Afro-Brazilian people have gone through. This is also a place where I've been very kind of on the side visiting and mm-hmm. building networks and relationships as well, because mm-hmm. I think the solutions are the same, but they may unfold in different ways based on the individual cultures, linguistics, restrictions, all of those things. But eventually, if you could then connect indigenous and Afro-Brazilian working together, there's still a common connection in, like, we are a resistance of people who have been discriminated, that if we work together, we can accomplish anything. And then there's the people in the middle and upper class, primarily white society, that can identify with that cause, that become supporters of helping elevate that cause until eventually everything can be integrated into one.
Which also means that there might be commonalities between all of us that we don't even see. Right? I like all of us, I like using those quadrant kind of things where you put like two nouns on two axes and then have those four quadrant thingies. And there's one that I find completely fascinating because we use it very commonly. It's about known and unknown things, right? And we know about things that are unknown, right? We know there's certain things that we don't know. And we know there are probably things that we don't even know we don't know them. And of course, there are things that we know, right? But everybody seems to ignore the fourth quadrant, which is, might there be unknown knowns? Right? Might there be things that sit deep inside of each of us as just because we're human beings that are kind of like, insights, things that are so natural to us, like reading, or if we can read, or speaking. Once we can speak, that are deeply embodied, but we are not aware of them, right? A bit like the beginning of your journey, that dissonance that you felt, right? Would you say there are things like that we all have in common, but not really on a noticeable level? And what would you say is that, and what would you say you would like us all to uncover so that things become easier?
Hey, you only ask very deep questions, huh?
I'm sorry, but that's what we're looking for.
Well, that's the realm I like to play in as well. So, look, I believe that the fundamental building block of everything that is love.
Okay.
And so if all of us are just a composition of molecules of love, then I think ultimately what all humans consciously or unconsciously are, and also have the purpose to create and hope to experience, is love in its deepest levels. Okay. And I think love is directly connected to happiness, which is what I spoke about at the beginning. I think all humans fundamentally at their core are happy and want to be happy. But sometimes they're very, very disconnected from that happiness, and more, and some people more than others. But if we can find what moves people towards happiness and build things from a true unconditional love, which is, I think the essence of the divine, the essence of God is unconditional love, which is very, very, very difficult in practice. But especially those of us that are trying to help build bridges, if we can truly practice that unconditional love, then we can awaken that in others. And if we can awaken the love and the happiness, then people will start to co-construct together a reality that's reflective of what moves all of us together in true and total coherence. And I think there is a unconscious coherence that's beyond the capacity of any of us to even understand, but that depending on the timeline of which you observe it within, it can seem incoherent. But if you look at the unlimited timeline of 100,000 years or 1 million years, you can see that all the things that had to happen, the breaks, the separations, the deconstruction, the construction, the war, they were all part of a coherent process of our collective consciousness that are leading us towards the same place. which is ultimately just the evolution of happiness and the evolution of love and the infinite expansion of that. So the what I hope is that as many of us as possible can get there as fast as possible to that that fundamental belief and that fundamental understanding, and can dedicate their lives to individual happiness. And I think if everyone dedicates their lives to individual happiness and love through love, then then ultimately it spreads naturally, because you don't have to tell somebody else how they have to be. You can, you know, if you're just being that example yourself, then naturally that spreads to other people. But I think so many times people are worried about what other people are doing. They're not taking care of their own happiness. And this is what creates space, emptiness for greed and hate and other things that that make the process of coherence take longer.
Very beautiful. I found a way to come at the same to the same conclusion from another direction about 10 years ago, when it kind of became obvious that there's a high probability of happening what's about to happen right now, which is machines becoming stronger in every imaginable way than us humans. And when I mean every imaginable way, I mean that they could be, it's easy to imagine something like a feeling of love being present for a machine, even if we cannot empathize with that machine love, right? But if it's a some advantage of the machinery to develop something like emotion, they will have it, they will do it, right? So I spent a year to think about what's actually the difference between us and machines, given all of that. And I couldn't really find anything, because I was looking for something positive, right? And towards the end of that year, I thought, okay, let's not find anything positive. I'm just happy to find anything. And almost immediately, once I had given myself that permission, I found vulnerability, because machines can roll back to yesterday's data state if the mind is broken or the soul is broken, right? They can put on a new arm if the arm is broken. They don't really, there's inherent in their being is vulnerability is missing, right? And inherent in our being is, if our mind, our soul, our body breaks, it's usually very hard to heal it, if at all, right? And that is the most common ground that I can see. And the most effective technology we have to heal our vulnerability and our wounds is love. And so completely different direction, but arriving at the exact same point, yeah. which I find so often. So, man, I want to thank you so much for the work you're doing, because what you're doing over there in the favelas of Rio will shine into other places and ultimately help us all. So thank you for all the work, and thank you for your time today.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's an honor to be able to have the opportunity to dedicate my life every single day to things that I believe in and things that I love and things that bring me happiness. And, you know, of course, there's a lot of sacrifice that comes with choosing to do something entirely different than what the system is set up to have you doing. Right. You know, you don't go to university and they teach you, okay, you know, go, you know, abandon everything, move across the world and live a life of purpose. You know, that's not what they're preparing you for.
Not really.
So it required a lot of kind of radical rebellion to say, you know, no, I'm not going to do all of those things, and I'm willing to sacrifice comfort in order to get there. But ultimately, I always say, you know, for me, the favela is my university. The deepest and most transformative things I've learned in my life are from the least educated people, who just through inherit persistence and resilience and you know, dedication to survival, especially in Brazil, where it's kind of their superpower is to sustain happiness in a situation where the majority of people in the world would be in a complete you know, state of despair. They're still dancing and singing and smiling and hugging their friends, you know. And so Brazil has taught me how to make happiness a permanent state that's not a condition of anything else that's happening. And for me, it's just an honor to be able to contribute to that. And I hope that our work in some way or another, whether it's in my lifetime or in other lifetimes, I'm not so concerned about, can reverberate in a positive way. And I appreciate, you know, people like you giving space and creating dialogue around this so that we can have this global, global connectivity, because it's going to take all of us, you know, that believe in a different state, working together and leveraging the resources that we have to really create this collective value.
Only together. Yes, only together. Only together.
We say in Portuguese, tamo junto. Tamo junto means we're all together.
Tamo junto. Okay. Thank you for this beautiful time, man.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure speaking.
All the best. Thank you.